When I was growing up in El Paso, Texas, I went to Scottsdale Elementary first, and then later on to Eastwood Heights Elementary. You probably don't care about that. But the truth was is that one of the things we did there is we had fences all around the schoolyards. Part of it is that El Paso, every yard has a fence. It's part of the building code, and it helps control things like snakes and wildfires and stuff like that. So they're really important. You really want a fence in El Paso, not to mention they make great neighbors. Anyhow, so we had these fences, lime rock fences everywhere, and around the school they had lime rock fences that were about 4 foot tall. The rest of it was cyclone fencing so you could make sure the wind would still pass because you want to have lots of air circulating when you're in the desert. Anyhow, we had these fences, and you know, me and all my friends, one of the things I noticed whenever I was living there is that we always would go out to the fence. We always say, hey, meet you out at the fence. And we would go out to the fence, especially like whenever I was in sixth grade, you know, it was really important that sixth graders, you hung out by the fence because you didn't want to be lame hanging up by the building with the little kids, you know. But we would play all over the place, and we would play our own version of soccer / rugby. It was very intense. You had to be there. And one of the things we purposely did is we put one goal right down by the fence, because that way when the ball got kicked, that fence was high enough, the chances were the ball wasn't going over, and it would help catch it if you didn't get it in the goal by chance. And even if you did get it in the goal, come to think of it, there was no net. And so we would play, and we played all over that yard. And the one thing you didn't want to do is you didn't want to be up by the building, because that's where, like I said, the little kids were and the teachers were monitoring us. And so we would go out and we would play all over the field. We had a great time. Fast forward, and next year I moved to Midland, Texas, or about 2 years later I moved to Midland, Texas, and the school was just within eyeshot of my house, and I remember one of the things is we drove by that school, and they said, there's Alamo Junior High, will you be going to school next year? And I was like, oh, great, I can't wait. But as we were driving by, I thought, that is the weirdest looking school I've ever seen. There's no fence. Not even around the football stadium. It's just wide open field. And I thought it was strange, but I didn't think that much about it. Didn't have to worry about it for a few months. Anyhow, next fall, I got in there and started, and I noticed that everybody played in the courtyard. Football, everything. When occasionally people would go out, I started getting people, let's go out. Why are we in the courtyard? Let's go out in the yard. And we would go out to the yard, but nobody went as far as the football field because it was all the way out at the street. Now, I got a couple of brave souls to go out with me a couple of times, but one of the things we quickly realized is how many people would just walk across the campus, shortcut. And lots of creepy things happened along that way, and we kind of looked at that, and it didn't take long for them to say, well, let's play football up closer to the building, because the teachers are in the courtyard anyhow. They're not out here watching us. It's cool. We can have a good time anyhow. So we moved our football game up close to the school. And I noticed even like at physical education and stuff like that, when we played things, we didn't go out to the football field. You know why? Because the coaches would say, it's not safe out there. The ball could roll into the street and everything. And I thought, that's funny. That's our football field. And they don't want us to play football on the football field. They want us to play football everywhere else. And we stayed really close to the building. We didn't go out to the edges. And I thought, you know, what this school really needs, as a kid I was thinking this, we could really use some good fences. These people in Midland, Texas have got it all wrong. We did it better in El Paso. Of course, that's what I was always thinking the whole time. But anyhow, I always think whatever you learned is the best way to do it. But we loved our fences, and we spent a lot of time hanging out on those fences. And when you would drive by any of those schools, even whenever I lived there as an adult, and I would drive by one of those schools, where was everybody? Hanging on the fences. They were hanging on the fences talking. They were hanging on the fences looking out. They were always out there by the fence doing their thing, and everybody felt safe. Well, you know, the fences are limits in one sense, and the fences are protection in another sense. It defines the playing field. It tells us, play here, it's safe. Play here, and I'll keep the boogeyman out. Play here, and you will not get hurt, run over, or kidnapped. And you know, God's law is like that. God's law really comes down to one of two views. Either we view it as something that confines us and constricts us and kills our joy, or we see it as something that brings blessing to us. It says, play here. Play all you want. Do all you want as long as you stay inside the fences and you'll be safe. But it's entirely up to us how we view it. Today, as we look at some of the application of the Ten Commandments, last week we did an overview of the Ten Commandments. Now we're going to look at a couple of chapters over the next few weeks, and we're going to be looking at the more defined explanation, some application here in the text of how those Ten Commandments work out among the people of Israel. And you and I are free to read either as God is putting limits on us, or that God is protecting us from our enemies, protecting us from destruction. We can read that God is giving us a safe place to play, or that God is interfering with our ability to play. But if you will allow me, I'd like to give you the reasons why I believe that God is not the cosmic killjoy, but a loving father. Let's take a look. Exodus chapter 21, and dive right in, beginning in verse 1. Now these are the rules that you shall set before them. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go free for nothing. If he comes in single, he shall go out single. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and the children shall be the master's, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love you, my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to God, and shall bring him to the door, or the doorpost. And his master shall bore in his ear through with an awl, and he shall be a slave forever. And when a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master, who has been designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no rights to sell her to a foreign people, since if he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for his sons, he shall deal with her as a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these things for her, she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place to which he may flee. But if a man willfully attacks another man to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from the altar that he may die. Whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Okay. When a man quarrel and one man strikes another with a stone or his fist, and the man does not die but takes to his bed, then if that man rises again and walks outdoors with his staff, he who struck him shall be clear, only he shall pay for the loss of his time and shall have him until he's thoroughly healed. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. But if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, for the slave is his money. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman, so that her child comes out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judge determines. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. And when a man strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall then let that slave go free because of his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of his slave, male or female, he shall let that slave go free because of his tooth. When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall not be liable. But if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and the owner has been warned but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and the owner shall be put to death. If a ransom is imposed on him, then he shall give the redemption of his life for whatever is imposed on him. If it gores a man's son or daughter, he shall be dealt with according to the same rule. And if the ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. When a man opens a pit, or when a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restoration. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead beast shall be his. When one man's ox butts another so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and share its price, and the dead beast shall also share. Or if it is known that the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and its owner has not kept it in, he shall repay ox for ox, and the dead beast shall be his. All right, lots of details in that law, and of course, if you keep reading chapter 22 and 23, you find a lot more details like that going point for point, going through all the details. But here's the thing, is as I was saying last week, and I need to say again, through Christ, we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. And it's not that we are innocent or that God just flippantly forgives us, but that his Son, Jesus Christ, paid the price for our sins with his blood, and then we are forgiven. It's not a flippant thing. It's not just God picking favorites and then, you know, excusing their behavior. It's not cheap. It's costly, very costly. Now, in this chapter, we read some things that make us pretty uncomfortable, like the death penalty for people who dishonor their parents, although I'm not sure that, okay, anyhow. Or the selling of a slave, or probably the most difficult for us, the selling of a female slave and her being the sexual property of her master. But understand this, that in their day, these laws were extremely liberal. For instance, first of all, it gave women legal rights at all. Understand, in their day, and up until about 200 years ago, there weren't women's rights. If you take a quick history, just Google it and start looking at women's rights, you quickly realize how few rights women have had until just recently. And so here we have women with rights in thousands of years ago. Second, it promised those female slaves essentially the same rights and benefits as that of a married woman, something that even 200 years ago in American slavery we did not give to slaves at all, and certainly not to the women. In fact, those female slaves had rights that women in America didn't have as recently as 100 years ago in terms of inheritance, divorce, and protection. Already vastly superior to what our law was at the turn of 1902. See, we forget those kind of things sometimes because we look at everything through the lens of where things have gone culturally for us, and then we try to sit in judgment of things that we really know nothing about. So in that process, what we see is instead protection, rights. It also put limits on retribution. Sometimes we scoff in our society at the idea of an eye for an eye. But the norm was a life for an eye. If you don't believe me, even look at the simple fact that Jacob's own sons, the 12 patriarchs of Israel, the original 12 tribe fathers, they had an instance where their sister was raped by a guy, and he wanted to marry her after he raped her. And they said, sure, we'll let you marry her, but first you must be circumcised. And the guy said, okay, I'll be circumcised. Me and my whole family, my father's tribes, all these tribes, we'll all be circumcised because I want her to be my wife. And then while they were laying there in pain, the 12 wonderful upstanding patriarchs murdered everybody in the city. Is that justice? See, norm in ancient culture was, we don't just get even, we're going to make you pay. And so when you read something like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, would you believe that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was limits? For instance, with an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, you can't get millions of dollars for having coffee spilled on your lap. So before we sit in judgment of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, we might want to review what's going on even in our own society and ask, are our laws actually as sane? Or Or is it that just that we have cultural values and we're viewing this law and judging it by our culture rather than by what's just? Could be that our sense of justice might be just a little bit skewed in what is fair. You see, here's the deal, is it promised restoration for loss. It protected the innocent in the case of an accident so that they couldn't be murdered because their animal got carried away. On the other hand, if the animal kept doing things to harm people, then you could be guilty. In other words, you don't pick animals over people, was the idea. And so it establishes protection of life, even protection of life for the unborn as a human being, unheard of in our enlightened age. My point is that if we were to go through this line by line, it could become rather tedious. We would probably lose our attention rather quickly, and I don't want to do that. But the thing is that I find interesting in this whole thing is that when you look at it in general, we give example after example of how the law should be applied. And what ends up happening in the spirit of all of that is that those who are weak and those who are powerless cannot be oppressed by the powerful. And that those who are disenfranchised, like the alien traveling among them, could be certain of equal and just representation under the law. Some of the things that we're fighting about in our own society right now about what's fair and just. And you know, I have kind of an interesting perspective on that, having been a missionary in Mexico, having brought my daughter in from Mexico and dealt with some of the laws on immigration and things like that. And while I'm not in favor of just a blanket amnesty and things like that, but I'll be honest, there's some real changes that need to happen. There's some real change. I tell you what, I was shocked at how much it cost to get my daughter immunizations at a U.S. customs agency. And I thought to myself, if as an American who was wealthy by Mexican standards, that it was hard for me to afford, I thought, how interesting. As I watched my Mexican friends apply for something that they could hardly afford, it took them several months' wages to apply for that visa. Then they get up to take their shots, and they had to go to the American-approved doctor, which was, let me tell you, you want to talk about a scam. There's one American-approved doctor, and there was thousands of people lined up to come across the border waiting for their chance to see that doctor at $175 a shot, an injection, and you need dozens. And I thought, there's something very unjust about this. And I watched as those friends would have saved up months of money not knowing that this was coming up. They would get there, they would not have enough money for the shots, and then they would be denied everything whenever they went to make their application, and they would have to start the process over again, go to the back of the line, and go through months, even years, of saving up again, getting ready, so that they could face the music one more time. And it became no wonder to me that so many of them just decided to jump the line and come to this country because they thought that there was a racket at the border. And so here is a law that said, you know what? You don't treat the alien and the disenfranchised people in your society unjustly. I wonder if we could learn anything from the Old Testament law in our land. But I'm sure it's, you know, it's so legalistic and so archaic, and it's just not fair, you know, all the things in the Old Testament law. Truly, I mean, the burden of the Old Testament law is just unfair, right? I mean, it's out of touch. It doesn't care about real justice. Or does it? You know, the funny thing is to me is that as I read it, I see a lot of things that I wish our legal system had. That there would be justice and mercy as normal enforcement of the laws, and that for people not to be abused by the weight of the law. My point is this, that within the law of God, there really is a sense of freedom. that there really is, for everyone whose desire is to honor God, it tells me where I can go, and everything from here to the fence is safe. There's a place to play. And when you think about it in terms of the whole idea that there would be care for people who are in slavery, or even people who are in a place in society where their life is very difficult, the idea that there would not have to be lawyers and things like that for the interpretation of the law. But, you know, the truth is that along the way, the Israelites thought that they were too enlightened for it too. And then they began to have lawyers. We read about them in the New Testament. They're always the bad guys. If you're a lawyer, I'm sorry. Just telling it like it is, telling you the storyline, the way it works. People always go, why don't we ever have lawyers in church? I'm like, I don't know, maybe they feel, you know, picked on. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be unfair here, because there are some good godly lawyers out there. I have met some. I actually know some. So I know, I'm looking at some faces, and no, really, there are. And neither one of them are related to me, but and there's a lot of lawyers in my family. So anyhow, no wonder we don't get invited to the family of things anymore. Okay, anyhow, seriously though, you know, the whole thing is that as they began to evolve in their process and they began to introduce lawyers into the whole process, that eventually what happened is we read in the Minor Prophets, the prophets say to the people and to the leaders in particular, you've completely forgotten justice. You see, eventually it began that the very law that was meant to bring freedom and protection began to be used to abuse those who were poor, the alien, and the person who was powerless. It's amazing how someone can take something that was meant to be full of freedom and twist the law in such a way that it would become harsh, unkind, legalistic. But you know, the realities are that as we read in the New Testament, you know, some of the most grace-filled verses I've heard used in such a way as to give me the impression that God is not merciful and kind. And on the other hand, I have heard verses and I've read things in the law in which in their setting and in their context, I began to realize that there was nothing but justice and mercy in those laws, and that the difference was the way in which they were read and the heart of the one who was approaching the law, whether it was full of justice or whether it was full of hate and oppression. You see, my point is this. The law is good. Even Psalm 19 says it this way. The law is good, rejoicing the heart. That by nature, that the law is a good thing. The Apostle Paul said it this way in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 6. The letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. You see, really, it's the way in which we approach these things. Think about things like the Sabbath. Jesus said that the Sabbath was for man and not man for the Sabbath. When the teachers of Judaism tried to hyper-focus on a few points of the law in an effort to make themselves stand apart from the Gentile world, not to be the light unto the Gentiles, but to be smug. They obsessed about the Sabbath. They obsessed about their kosher diet. And these things that were meant to bless the Israelites with rest and safe food became an obsession about washings designed to protect them from diseases and supposed to give them life. And instead, all those things began to bring death. So you read through those details, and it doesn't take long for you and I to get bogged down in the Ten Commandments and to see them as law that brings death rather than a spirit of which brings life. I go back to that whole time when I was a kid and standing in the fenced yard. You see, the fence was there for our protection. And one of the things that never crossed my mind as a kid is whether or not it was all right to get close to the fence. Never crossed my mind. We hung out at the fence. We spent a lot of time at the fences. There was nothing wrong with that. And I think one of the things that we do as a disfavor to people is we preach the gospel, which is supposed to mean good news, and we preach about the law in such a way that we go, yeah, I know that's not the law, but you better not. Can you think of all the cultural things that we do in the church that are not in the Bible? There's lots of things, isn't there? There's lots of things that the church spends most of its energy on in fear that somebody might get near the fence. And it doesn't give life. Instead, we worry about what other people think about us to the point that many times people just evacuate from church, quietly slip out the back door, and are never heard from again. And it's become a really prevalent thing within our culture and society that most of the people I meet out on the street and in the community tell me that they're Christians. And I go, really, where do you go to church? Oh, I don't go to church. Why not? And this, no matter how they word it, is essentially the issue. You see, they have been beat up by the secondary fences that we've placed because we're afraid that somebody might get to the fence. Can I tell you something? There's something really creepy about the idea that you are more holy than God, that you get to set the fences for other people. Play to the fences. Play to the fences. It is not your job to set somebody else a boundary that you might need for your own life. For instance, you may have a problem with spending too much time on the internet or going places that you shouldn't go. That doesn't mean that everybody else needs your particular filter or your particular guidelines for spending time on the internet. You might have a problem with television. You might really need to put some things in check. You might have a problem with alcohol. You might have a problem with dancing, but it is not your job to make the law for everyone else to tell them that they can't go dancing or they can't watch television or they can't have a beer. That is not the gospel. That's your bad news. Hello? You see, the law is God's boundaries. And those things are your boundaries, and you may well need to set them. I know for myself that there are things that I need to set up boundaries in my own life that have no effect on anyone else. I just know that that's true for myself. But there is not anything in those things that I believe that everybody needs to do. You see, when I was in Bible college, I remember that there was a guy who wrote a book. And we had to, in every test, write our answers word for word exactly what he'd said in that book. And I remember another professor that was kind of tired of hearing us complain about that particular professor because he agreed with us. And one of the things he said, you know, he goes, my problem with that book is this. When I was a young man, I thought I was going to write a book that said, agree with me or go to hell. But I figured out that God had already written that book. And my book wasn't needed. And he said, and you know what? He said, I don't think his book is needed either. Because he's essentially written that book. So I want to say to the church, in all earnestness, run to the fences. Play in the entire yard. And when you look at the law through the spirit of liberty and of life-giving opportunity. That it's not God's desire to crush you to. Can I be honest? How does it make sense that the same God, the God who is yesterday and forever, would give the life of his very own son if his desire was to squish you and take your life and steal from you? It makes no sense. If he wanted to do that, he already had the opportunity. You see, because the reality is as I look at the letter of the law, I could certainly condemn myself. I'm pretty good at it, aren't you? Yeah, unfortunately, I'm all too good at it. But this is what I know. That the benefits of God's law, of knowing God, give me the opportunity to play freely inside those boundaries. To walk in integrity before God. And for Him to be my sole judge. And that if I'm really loving as a brother or sister in Christ, that I will pull the log from my own eye before I deal with the speck in my brother's eye, and maybe come alongside and say, you know, I love you and I care about you. I see you struggling with something, and I'd like to come alongside of you. That's fair. It's just. But to sell someone else that they have to do it your way, that is legalism. See, the truth is, folks, is that we don't get legalism from the law. We get legalism from our attitudes. So let me invite you to do that. To love God, to love His people, and run to the fences. I'll race you. Let's stand together. You know, one of the things I've found is that when people begin to experience freedom in Christ, that it doesn't all come overnight. There's lots of things that people wrestle with voices in their head and in their heart, and the ability to enjoy the freedom in Christ is difficult. It's difficult at best. I used to say, you know, teasingly, well, you know, I spent 3 years in seminary and 5 years getting over it, and you know what? I spent 10 years in a really legalistic denomination and 15 getting over it. I was amazed at how, even though I was preaching Christ and living in that freedom, that how many times I was constantly looking over my shoulder to see who was judging me, constantly worried about what people thought of me. I'm not saying that we should live in a way that's reckless or anything like that. But maybe you're here this morning and the reality is that you've been living under the weight of judgment of other people's values, and church has just not been a safe place. I want to tell you, there's some prayer people back there with orange badges on, and they would love to pray with you about experiencing freedom in Christ, about the ability to run freely for the fences. Maybe you're here this morning and, man, this is a hard message to hear. Maybe it is really creating a lot of pain and dissonance for you because you've heard nothing but the heavy weight of the law, and you're afraid of what this could mean. And I understand that. I've been there. I've made that journey. I know what it's like to be under the weight of that and wonder, in doing this, am I going to just open up to all kinds of permissiveness? Let me tell you this. Whether you open up to this or not, you will not stop other people from behaving in a way that is unhealthy. You will not ever convince people to live a godly life in step with the Spirit by simply trying to control them. They will run from you. They will stop listening to you. They will leave church. They will stay out of your life. They'll unfriend you on Facebook. They'll do whatever is necessary to shut you out and shut you up. But the opportunity to give life exist in the open-handedness of being there with people and helping them to walk, helping them to make good judgments, to weigh out the weight of what the law really means and not the letter of it. And you will never get that opportunity if you shut them out of those doors and out of your life with legalism. So I want to invite you, if you're there and you're struggling with this, then would you go visit with some of these prayer team people as well? Would you turn to somebody next to you and just simply say, you know, would you pray with me? I don't know how to live like that. And I'm going to need to really clearly hear the voice of the Lord. I'm going to really need to clearly sense the leading of God's Spirit for me to be able to walk this out. And I don't know if I can do it, but I know He can. So let me invite you. Why don't you join them for prayer in the back, or pray with the person next to you. And after this song is over, they're going to come up here, make more room so you can go in and out of the doors freely. But there'll be prayer team up here after this song and available to pray with you. But pray. And enjoy the fruit of walking in step with God. God bless you. Let's worship together.